Part 1. The Weighing of the Heart. Chapter 1. Torquatum. To Maluka. Choose wisely.
The horizon is wrong, said Hathomart,
and Ahriman felt the psychic pressure of the Pavoni adept's power as he altered his internal biology to better cope with the magnificent orbital's disorientating perspectives.
In what way? Asked Ahriman.
In the way that there isn't one?
That wasn't exactly true, but Hathomart had a point. There was a horizon, just not one immediately recognizable as such. The Torquatum was an open, latticework globe of 9 interlocking rings in constant motion. The smallest was 36 kilometers in diameter, the largest 54. Viewed through the oculus on the bridge of the Kemet, it had seemed impossibly fragile, yet its dimensions were the equal of Kalth's orbital anchorages. Matching speed and aspect, the hawk-winged stormbird had borne the 6 Legion warriors to the edge of a glittering forest of warp veins on the inner face of the Torquatum's equinoctial ring. Perspective made its structure taper as it arced overhead in a gentle upward slope before reaching its apex of curvature and reversing to descend behind them. Each ring's curve was perfectly proportioned, and at the center of the slowly rotating concentric arrangement was a bronzed sphere, held fast by a connecting shaft running between 2 polar braces. Transhuman biology, combined with powered battleplate, should have rendered the Legion warriors immune to vertigo, but the orbital's incredible structure was doing its best to test that. Even Lucius of the Emperor's Children and Sanact of the Athenaeans, consummate bladesmen both, stepped cautiously. Tolbeck of the Pyrae was a coiled spring, his ascendant power simmering close to the surface. Ahriman's Corvidae Practicus, Sobek, kept close to his master, doing his best to conceal his spatial discomfort. Only Menkaura appeared unaffected, the venerable battle-seer reveling in their disquieting surroundings.
Oh, a magnificent structure,
he said, as a crystalline bronze arrangement of oculus lenses, encrusted with psychic resonators, slid soundlessly through space 1,000 meters overhead. Ahriman nodded and recited a Corvidae mantra, easing his consciousness into the lower enumerations. The churning sensation in his gut subsided only slightly.
True,
he agreed, lifting his gaze to the vast maelstrom of warp energy, filling the void beyond the Torquatum's wirework structure.
But its masters have chosen to observe a uniquely dangerous phenomenon. The Eye of Terror,
whispered Menkaura, the words echoing like a curse within Ahriman's helm.
A name freighted with familiarity, though I cannot remember knowing it until recently. Indeed,
said Menkaura.
As though this area of space has always cleaved to the name, and only now chooses to reveal it. An interesting theory, said Ahriman. Further discussion is perhaps best saved until our mission is complete.
Though apparently open to the void, an integrity field larger than anything Ahriman had previously encountered maintained a breathable atmosphere within the Torquatum's rings and kept the full force of the Eye at bay. Every surface crackled with warp ghosts, flickering images at the corner of the Eye that vanished as soon as they were noticed.
The structure is misnamed, said Sobek, sickly warp light reflecting on his helm's coppered visor.
The crimson of his armor reminded Ahriman of sunsets reflecting from the Tizcan pyramids. The original ones, not the skeletal ruins scattered in the lightning-racked deserts of their adopted refuge.
How so?
Said Tolbeck, dropping to one knee and placing a palm on the metal deck plates. Blue flames sprang to life around his black gauntlet, slithering from his arm like questing snakes in search of prey. Sobek waved his Hecker staff, its ivory length topped by a mass of carven eyes.
It more resembles a vast armillary sphere, a primitive heliocentric model of the celestial vault,
with a spherical framework of rings representing astral longitudes and latitudes. Ahriman moved past his practicus, kneeling at a 5-meter-wide focus aperture in the ring upon which they had landed. No matter that the equinoctial portion of the Torquatum was 1 kilometer wide and 100 meters thick, it still felt absurdly fragile to be moving at speed through the void. Perfectly framed within the aperture's lens was the bronze sphere at the heart of the Torquatum. Exactly 15 kilometers in diameter, the geocentric rings encircling it turned with artful grace. Ahriman's eyes told him the globe was below him, but the knot of vertigo in his gut insisted he should be falling upwards.
"So if this is an observatory, where are the observers?"
said Tolbeck, extinguishing the flames enveloping his gauntlet.
"We are here at the appointed site and should not linger in open space where the dogs of Russ might catch our scent. We have not the strength to defend ourselves."
The Pyrae had ever been the bluntest of psychic disciplines among the Legion, but with the inevitable turning of the Great Ocean, their fellowship was now in ascendance. As the seer sight of the Corvidae waned, the Pyrae's strength waxed. Yet for all Tolbeck's brusqueness, Ahriman had been wondering the same thing. The reply to their hail from the Kemet had been binaric only, no vox or pict, a set of coordinates and a precise time. Ahriman had a flash of premonition and rose to his feet as a seamless panel slid open in the curvature of the ring. A curiously angled set of steps was revealed, midnight black marble with traceries of sapphire veins. Sanakt's jackal and hawk blades flashed from their sheaths, glittering white and black. Lucius had his sword drawn fractionally faster, and his loathsome whip coiled in the air like a serpent.
"Perhaps this is them," said Sobek.
Ahriman blinked away the disorientating impression that the steps within were somehow inverted as a group of figures wrought from chrome and jet emerged. Their heads were featureless ceramic ovoids with mercury-bright sigils glittering like brands at the centre. No two were alike, and Ahriman saw crude, goetic echoes in their arrangement. Names? Perhaps drawn from the 72 demons evoked by the scribe of Baphomet.
"Ah, of course,"
said Mancora, turning to Sanakt.
"Your Athenaean's inability to discern the thoughts behind the vox becomes clear."
"Robots,"
said Hathor Mart, casting his gaze over the porcelain skulled automata.
"They sent robots."
Ahriman heard his sneer, an all too common reaction from the Pavoni adept since their harrowing on Prospero. The automata advanced on the Thousand Suns, the smoothness of their movements telling of the love and craft that had gone into their creation. Such purity of purpose brought to mind the duel between Lucius and Sanakt, the instant before the scarred swordsman launched his final blow. Ahriman's seer sight saw black flames within the automata. He shook his head.
"These are not robots. Yokai."
Ahriman recognized the sigil as a word form belonging to a long-vanished empire of old Earth, a mythical creature of some kind, but its deeper meaning eluded him. Athava would have known. His abrasive Corvidae brother had been fascinated by the legends of the Dragon Nations. He would have told them everything there was to know of the Yokai, etymological analysis of the name, folk tales, and all manner of esoteric trivia. But Athava had left the Legion decades ago to join the Crusader host and was almost certainly incarcerated somewhere on Terra. Perhaps he was the lucky one, spared the humbling at the hands of the wolves. The Thousand Suns wore the shame of their defeat like a shroud, and the Crimson King was yet to decree when their mourning would end. Or if it ever would. Hathor Mat had dismissed the 9 Yokai as robots, and the comparison was inescapable. Though crafted in imitation of perfected human anatomy, like the legendary king of the Myrmidons, their blue steel forms were still undeniably mechanical. Slender-limbed and graceful, Ahriman saw implacable strength in their forms, coupled to etheric energies burning within each skull.
"If they're not robots, what are they?"
asked Lucius, the warp energy within the Yokai invisible to him.
"Perhaps something similar to the Goylem?" of the six orders? Suggested Sobek.
These are neither crude nor unshaped, replied Araman.
So much more than robots, said Sanact,
his silver-faced death mask helm reflecting the automata's etheric fire.
More akin to tutelaries summoned into exquisite host bodies.
Tutelaries? Spat Tolbeck, his hand tightening on the inlaid serpent-scale grip of his sword. The light of his helm lenses flickered with immaterial flame.
What's a tutelary?
Asked Lucius, as his whip twitched in anticipation of violence. Amon had counselled against allowing the Phoenician's warrior to be part of this venture. Araman and the Primarch's equerry seldom agreed these days, yet on this they were in accord. But watching Lucius hack his way through the crystal forest to Sanak's tower, Araman had seen how closely the hateful swordsman's fate was bound to theirs. All the pieces matter.
Warp entities, said Mancora. Boon companions, or so we believed, called from the great ocean to boost our powers, aid our divinations, and shed light on the mysteries.
Let me guess, they turned on you.
Mancora nodded.
Indeed they did. How did you know?
You can only keep a dog on a leash so long before it remembers it's a wolf,
said Lucius, the fingers on his sword hand flexing.
Should we be worried?
I do not believe so, said Araman, studying the Invocatus formulae etched around the bright sigils.
These are compelled to obedience, where ours were allowed to come and go as they pleased.
Then the Torquatum's observers show more caution than we ever did, said Mancora.
The yokai halted before the Thousand Suns, and Araman resisted the urge to rise into a more warlike enumeration. After Prospero, his natural inclination had turned from inquisition to suspicion. He awaited some form of communication. His armour could translate by Narek quickly enough for legitimate conversation, but as he formed his words in the machine cant of the Mechanicum, another figure emerged from the ring's structure. Compact, and with an economy of movement that put Sanak to shame, she was swathed in a simple devotional robe of saffron, cinched at the waist by a black sash. Her face was open and ascetically androgynous, with a skull shaven bare, save for a trio of braided scalp locks hanging down to the backs of her knees. One eye was cataract blind, the other swimming with colour, as though coated with a film of petrochemicals. A practitioner of the artes, one whose power was great, yet altered by immaterial energies. The yokai parted, and she bowed deeply.
"Greetings, travellers," she said. "I am Temeluka, mistress of the Tartaruki."
Araman returned her bow.
"And I am Azek Araman,"
he almost added proud son of Magnus the Red, but settled instead for
"a warrior of the Crimson King."
Temeluka smiled, pretending not to notice his hesitation.
"My order knows of you and Magnus the Red," she said. "The great ocean echoes to your sire's name."
Wary now, Araman hid his surprise and said,
"You know our purpose in coming here."
Temeluka bowed again and gestured to the opening through which she and the yokai had emerged.
"The same reason that draws all travellers with questions to the Torquatum," she said,
her warp-sheened eye glittering with witchfire.
"You seek answers from the iron oculus."
Following Temeluka and the yokai through the portal, Araman felt a wrenching sense of dislocation, a bilious tremor in the belly, like a starship crashing from the great ocean. His auto-senses shrieked with static, distorting his every sense as its system struggled to form an image in his visor. A savage rush of vertigo slammed through Araman, and he gripped his hecker staff tightly. The need to vomit climbed his gullet, and he unsnapped the seals of his helm, tearing it from his gorget to draw in a sucking breath.
"Take a moment to balance your elements, and the feeling will pass," said Temeluka.
Araman nodded, not yet trusting he could speak without sounding like a fool. His thoughts were scattered like knuckle bones in a casting, and he eased his mind into the ordered thought forms of the lower enumerations before opening his eyes. The breath caught in his throat as he found himself at the centre of a glass platform, adrift in an endlessly unfolding tesseract of crystalline stairways, rising and falling or intersecting at impossible angles, defying perspective like the mythical works of the Niederlanter Knight. Distant figures endlessly climbed with weary steps, but skewed angles and dazzling reflections quickly obscured them. Ahriman shook off a curious melancholy at the sight and turned to his more immediate surroundings. The platform was translucent and eniagonal, with one of the yokai at each of its edges. Their placement was that of the symbol of Thothmes, a potent ward to secure those within from scrying. His companions surrounded him, all but Lucius, similarly beset by the disorientating change in their surroundings. Sobek was on his knees, eyes wide and body taut, as he struggled to remove his helmet.
Sobek,
said Ahriman in an urgent mind pulse. His practicus nodded and used his eye-topped staff to push himself to his feet. Sobek's skin was pale and drawn, his flesh waxy.
Sobek, repeated Ahriman. Are you effective?
I am,
confirmed Sobek, bending to retrieve his helm. Ahriman turned from Sobek as Sanakt's voice whispered in his mind, hidden and subtle.
Do you see? The inscriptions below our feet.
Ahriman looked down. The depths of the glass was filled with coiled golden script, rippling as though viewed through water.
Raptures, he managed. I do not recognize them. Look closer,
pressed Sanakt. Ahriman stretched out his will, attempting to impose a measure of solidity to the formulae swimming within the glass, but they resisted easy interpretation. He exhaled slowly and rose into the third enumeration, his clarity returning as his mind's eye picked out arrangements he did recognize.
Athenian constructions.
Variant rapture forms of those we use to craft phantasms in the minds of enemy warriors,
replied Sanakt, with an almost imperceptible nod.
Amid such impossible surroundings, we should not take even that which appears incontrovertibly real at face value.
Good advice, replied Ahriman,
lifting his gaze to the edge of the platform and seeing vast processional stairs rise up before him, each step cohering the exact instant his eyes beheld it. Unlike the tessellated stairs surrounding them, these climbed arrow straight for hundreds of meters towards a magnificent structure, an ornamented temple with a many-tiered tower of multiple upturned eaves. Its silver and jade pillared facade was monolithic, with a black gate of lacquered wood at its center. Stone dragons stood watch at either end of its eaves, and once again Ahriman wished he'd shared Athava's enthusiasms for the cultures of old Earth.
What is that?
Asked Ahriman.
It is the Kayong, the silver pavilion, wherein dwells the iron oculus,
explained Temaluka.
It is what you came for.
That was truer than she knew, but Ahriman chose not to elaborate on the Crimson King's purpose in sending them here. He nodded and said,
We are ready.
Ahriman climbed the stairs alongside Temaluka, looking to unmask the raptures the plaza below had wrought, but he could see nothing beyond the myriad shifting stairways and the looming temple. Great power had gone into the creation of this phantasmagoria, and Ahriman took a moment to study its presumed architect. Temaluka's skin was sunless, her curious eye a sign of great control over her abilities. To have endured so obvious a mutation and its attendant consequences, while retaining her humanity, spoke volumes as to her strength of will. Ahriman's warriors climbed behind him in echelon. Sobek, Hathomart, and Sanakt to his left, Menkora, Tolbek, and Lucius to his right. The yokai flanked them, the warp entities bound to their mechanized bodies guttering like banked furnaces. Despite the tutelary's betrayal, a shocking reversal that had gutted the Thousand Suns' defense of Prospero, Ahriman still missed Ait Peo's soothing presence.
Might I ask a question?
Of course, said Temaluka. But the iron oculus has the answers you seek, I fear I will be a poor substitute.
A modest answer, said Ahriman with a short bow, but one I am disinclined to accept.
Temaluka smiled.
Ask, and I will endeavour to answer.
You said you were the mistress of the Tartaruki,
said Ahriman, gesturing to the temple above.
The name implies a role of guardianship.
You have read the Akmim Gospels of Esdras, Master Azek?
Said Temaluka.
The Syriac translation, many years ago, replied Ahriman,
understanding Temaluka was merely stating a fact, not asking a question.
And that copy has sadly been lost.
When the wolves brought the fire.
Ahriman nodded. Prospero's fall was a raw wound to his heart, but the pain came not from its doom, rather the horror of what had been lost in the ashes. An incalculable repository of hard-won knowledge and earned experience burned like the priceless texts of Persepolis, millennia of accumulated wisdom torn from existence in a willful act of intellectual vandalism.
Prospero's death was a loss to all mankind, not just the Thousand Sons, said Ahriman.
And the pain of such woeful understatement almost broke his heart anew.
The iron oculus tells us that knowledge is never lost, said Temaluka without breaking stride. It can fade, like forgotten tales that sink into the mire of memory, remembered only by lonely spinners of verse, until it is needed and rises once more into dreams.
Poetic, but you did not answer my question.
You did not ask a question, pointed out Temaluka.
Very well, said Ahriman. Is the iron oculus your prisoner?
Temaluka smiled and said,
The writings of Esdras claim that Tartaruki were once angels, and that their vengeful gods set them before the gates of an infernal prison to guard against the return of a great devil.
She gave Ahriman the look of a scholar jaded by too many garlanded histories to be impressed by such ancient hyperbole.
Once again you evade answering.
Irritation, quickly masked, shadowed Temaluka's face. Clearly she was unused to her words being so carefully scrutinized, but had likely never met warrior scholars of the Thousand Sons.
The iron oculus is shackled to the Torquatum, yes, but through no design of ours.
So someone imprisoned it?
Perhaps.
But the iron oculus never speaks of itself.
And you do not ask?
What would be the benefit?
Knowledge, said Ahriman. The rendering of things unknown into fact. To trust the words of so powerful a captive without knowing why it was imprisoned seems somewhat incautious.
We have faith in our purpose, replied Temaluka.
Faith, said Ahriman, unable to keep the venom that had been building within him since Prospero's death from his voice. All faith teaches is the virtue of not questioning, of blindly accepting dogma and holding things as sacred merely because they were deemed so in an earlier age by less enlightened souls.
Then why are you here, if not in faith that your questions will be answered?
It is not faith that brings me here.
Then what does?
The will of the Crimson King, said Ahriman,
as they reached the top of the stairs and the majesty of the Silver Pavilion. A plaza of frost-rimed cobbles spread before the temple, and snow fell in flurries of glittering dust. Flakes landed on Ahriman's armour, glistening for a fleeting moment before melting like teardrops. More of the Tartaruki awaited them. 8 adepts clad in loose-fitting robes of deepest blue, and each bearing a unique symbol stitched over their heart. Their arms were bare and heavily tattooed, a mix of fractal spirals, number sequences, and recursive labyrinths. Like Temaluka, their eyes were warp-touched, one blinded, the other all-seeing. The symbolism was not lost on Ahriman. He wondered if the Tartaruki were aware of the Prosperine significance of their mutation. A second thought came on the heel of the first. Had Magnus the Red been here before? Arrayed to left and right, like regiments on a parade ground, hundreds of yokai stood in ordered ranks, motionless but for the etheric flames within them. Temaluka marched between the mechanized host bodies as the other members of her order joined her. No introductions were offered, nor did Ahriman seek any. The lacquered black gate swung open at Telemuka's approach, and a pillared hall of porphyry and jade was revealed. Cold light and reflections danced within. Ahriman followed the mistress of the Tartaruki inside, seeing that the entire space of the silver pavilion was given over to a multitude of crystal-fronted cabinets, arrayed like trophies in a museum of conquest. The thousand suns spread out, examining the displays with scholarly interest. Some cabinets contained elaborately wrought weapons, others artifacts of non-human origin, but most contained freakish skeletal remains. Ahriman threaded a path between the exhibits, marvelling at the incredible diversity, intuitively knowing this was but a fraction of what the structure contained. His steps carried him deeper inside, his gaze flitting between the ever more varied items on display, a gleaming endoskeleton surmounted by a silver death's head helm with lambent green eyes and a geometric rune at its forehead, a series of arthropodal creatures with biomechanical stilt legs, captured nebulae of glittering vapor light held in jeweled vacuum flasks. The deeper he penetrated, the more obvious it became that the internal dimensions of the temple were subtly wrong. Like Keri Adha's gardens of rock and bleached gravel, laid out according to the Sakuteki's exacting specifications, aspects of the museum's contents were revealed or obscured relative to the viewer's perspective. What was visible from one vantage point was hidden from another, and entirely new exhibits were revealed. Perhaps the entirety of the silver pavilion was on display. He just had not been positioned correctly within its multidimensional space to see it. Ahriman paused beside a cabinet in which an exquisite suit of bone-white armour was encased. The fluid grace of its artifice spoke of Eldar craft, and Ahriman sensed ageless, silent fury chained within. The helm was crafted as a howling scepter, with a blood-red plume coiled on a shoulder guard like a serpent poised to strike. A long shiver spear was slung at the figure's shoulder, and one bladed gauntlet clenched a tri-bladed throwing weapon. Ahriman needed no seer sight to know immobility was anathema to the thing bound to this armor.
"What is this place?" he asked.
"A reminder that not all who seek knowledge ought to find it," said Temuluka.
Ahriman tapped his hecker staff against the crystal, and he felt the enraged spirit within hunger for his death.
"This is Eldar," he said.
"It is," agreed Temuluka. "A soul-eating revenant from the earliest age of their doom. Its witchkin masters led it here to destroy the Iron Oculus. They failed."
"And you killed them?"
"What lives within that armor can never truly die."
Ahriman had studied the Eldar myth cycles enough to know their warrior gods were fated to return when needed most. He leaned in to the crystal prison and said,
"Your race is dying, and you will not save them."
The spirit of the armor strained against its wards, but the warp craft of the Tartaruki rendered its fury impotent. With Temuluka at his side, Ahriman followed a spiraling path towards the center of the silver pavilion, keeping one eye on his fellow thousand suns as they too drew inwards. The shifting arrangement of exhibits changed with every step he took. Previously visible artifacts vanished from sight, and others appeared in their place. As Ahriman stepped into the pavilion's centre, he stopped beside the fleshless remains of a fossilized greenskin with a monstrously swollen hydrocephalic skull.
"How do you come by these exhibits?" he asked.
Temuluka clasped her hands before her.
"The silver pavilion contains more secrets than even we know," she said. "My predecessor believed that what it chooses to reveal are swept from places within the great ocean, where past and future collide. She told me that no two souls will see the same thing."
Her words rang false, but before he could ask more, his steps brought him to the heart of the silver pavilion. Shimmering rainbows of light cascaded from an octagonal shaft rising into the tower he had seen from outside. A pair of screw stairs, one translucent crystal, the other obsidian, offered ascent, entwined in a double helix.
The iron oculus awaits at the summit, said Temaluka. But only you and I may climb the twin stairs.
We go alone.
Like all who come here.
Ahriman looked back at his legion brothers, the yokai and the robed adepts of the Tartaruki. His warriors knew what to do, and little would be served by disputing the issue of his lone ascent to the bound oracle. He nodded to Menkaura and Sobek. His practicus returned the nod, his body thrumming with barely suppressed tension. Ahriman approached the corkscrewing stairs. Each step was engraved with golden lettering, but where the words on the platform below were virtually illegible, these were phosphor-bright and easily read. Another Prosperine echo. This time of the paved approach to the Palace of Wisdom in the heart of Lost Tisca. The marble slabs leading to the palace had been engraved with aphorisms from the great library's most lauded contributors. The first crystal step read, "The higher we are placed, the more humbly we should walk." Ahriman grinned mirthlessly as he read the obsidian step. "From the errors of others, a wise man corrects his own."
"Choose your path, Azek Ahriman," said Temaluka, "and choose wisely."
Ahriman looked up into the falling borealis of light and chose obsidian. Each step brought fresh words of wisdom. After the fourth step, Ahriman stopped reading them. They were nothing he did not already know. The museum faded from sight as he climbed, but he had expected as much, suspecting this would be a metaphorical ascent as much as a literal one. Infinite space unfolded in angles unknown to geometry, and curvatures beyond the wit of calculus to solve. A trillion galaxies orbited him, smears of diamond dust on velvet amid rivers of light spun from earlier epochs of existence. This was the workings of the universe laid bare, the secret face of all creation that some called gods, but which the thousand suns called ether. It was vast and empty, yet behind the veil of stars, Ahriman felt the reptilian gaze of a vast and malign consciousness. A pagan soul might claim to feel the eye of the gods upon him, but not Azek Ahriman. Not any more. His only anchor to solidity was the steps, plunging below him to unimaginable depths and rising to dizzying heights. None of it was real, at least in the mundane sense, but anything a mind could perceive would in effect be real, no matter how much the physical world might disagree. Temaluka climbed the crystal stairs, and they wove around one another like dancers at the first notes of music. Or gladiators in the opening moments of a death match. The second image was potent, the rising influence of the pyri not entirely robbing him of seer sight. Ahriman veiled the thought, risking a glance towards Temaluka. Had she caught his flash of insight? It did not appear so. Ahriman kept climbing, watching the dance of stars from their gravity-wrought births to their explosive endings. He saw firefly sparks of what must be space-faring civilizations spread and contract in the blink of an eye, dead and forgotten even as he noticed them. Galaxy-wide wars blazed between ancient gods and their immortal enemies, leaving bleeding scars on the fabric of space-time. A thousand empires rose and fell before the collapse of the molecular cloud that gave rise to the solar system.
"All is dust,"
said Temaluka, barely more than a whisper.
"Is that what this is?"
asked Ahriman, raising his hand to the natural beauty of the stars.
"A lesson in the entropic nature of existence, that all things decay to their ending?"
"Nothing so trite,"
replied Temaluka, a hint of genuine remorse in her tone.
"Then what?"
"Call it a future echo of a warning that will go unheeded."
Ahriman tapped his shoulder guard where a raven's head was carved within the serpentine halo of his legion iconography.
"First principles of the Corvidae," he said. "The past is carved in stone, the future an endlessly branching river."
"No," said Temaluka, "it is not."
Ahriman paused in his ascent and locked eyes with the mistress of the Tartaruki.
And this coming from one who stands sentinel over an oracle?
Temeluka reached across and placed her palm over the Corvidae raven's head. The light of the universe faded, and the sense of being observed by inhuman intelligences was now entirely absent. The awful silence of non-existence enveloped them both.
I have only moments, Azek Ahriman,
said Temeluka, with what he could only interpret as fear of discovery.
You should not have come here. Leave now and never return.
I cannot do that,
he said, puzzled by her urgency.
The Crimson King has spoken, and I must obey.
It will not always be so, said Temeluka. One day you will face him as an enemy.
You have seen such a future?
It is one of many the Iron Oculus has shown us.
Then it is irrelevant,
said Ahriman, losing patience with Temeluka.
And such future echoes are meaningless without context. End this charade. Bring me to your oracle, and we will see if it even deserves such a title.
As you wish, said Temeluka.
And the starlight bloomed like trillions of unblinking eyes.
All is dust, repeated Temeluka. Remember that, when all about you is ash and despair.